This is the Paula Gordon Show. It is a great pleasure to be with Simon Sharma. Bill Russell, is it your turn or can I go on?
Go ahead. The one thing we have not done, for those people who have not read this book cover to cover.
Which you absolutely should.
Which we insist. Actually, you should read everything
Say
prior to this.
About, right?
We probably should give people a little idea of what this is about, right, and then the scope of it. And it's,
shall I do
and
that?
It's
a,
well,
it,
yes. Why don't you
well, it's
do
a
that?
Very rich story.
Yeah,
and,
it is.
And I think you're much better qualified to do that than either of us.
I told you I didn't know about the story at all at the beginning. No, it has wonderful emblematic. Let me give you two human emblems of the story. The first one is Patrick Henry's slave, Ralph, who 1 week after his master gets up and says, give me liberty or give me death, says to himself, one assumes, I think I'll have liberty, and goes as fast as he possibly can to the British. Same thing was true of one of George Washington's favorite slaves, called Henry Washington. And there's a slave I found who changed his slave name to British Freedom. Now, there are three people, and you multiply them by all the way up to, since I'm on a book tour, therefore I have no arithmetic left at all, to between 80 and 100,000 people have felt the same way. Why did they feel that way? I mean, it's one of the great exoduses in all of American history, really, this extraordinary mass of people running as hard. And when I say running, I mean that metaphorically. They went by boat, they traveled at night, they went on foot, they went in families. Before the war, runaways from plantation, almost entirely, as you'd expect, young adult males. There are almost as many women as there are men, with small children, grannies with babies. It's an incredibly moving thing. And we know that from all sources, from the sources from the British themselves, are overwhelmed by the numbers. And we know it from the patriots, from no less a source than Jefferson. Now, why they're doing this? They're doing it, why are the British offering freedom in return for service, not, you'll all be relieved to hear, or not, out of the milk of human kindness. There are people on the British side who indeed follow through with humanitarian sincerity, but the policy starts as an act of pure military desperation. The last governor of Virginia is down to his last 300, last royal governor of Virginia is down to his last 300 redcoats. So he's called Lord Dunmore. He's a basic imperial nitwit. He issues a proclamation in November which says any indentured servants and Negroes prepared to serve the king will have freedom as in return for their service, or words to that effect. But the word freedom is used. And that's what triggers this extraordinary response. So there are indeed very large numbers of African Americans who are part of the train of the British Army, a small number only who are armed combatants, but important ones at the Siege of Savannah, for example.
And at this same time, there are slave revolutions happening in South America.
There are, which is why this whole idea, the Patriots knew that the British were doing this unscrupulously, but they were terrified about the consequences because there are enormous rebellions going on in Suriname, in the north of the South America, and in St. Vincent, and in a little part of Jamaica, and the beginnings of a huge one in what becomes the biggest of all in Saint-Domingue, what we now call the Dominican Republic. So, in fact, because of the close connections of the world of southern planters with the Caribbean and with South America, and the reports coming through of, you know, people being massacred, they had a vivid sense what happened when slaves got guns, and it scared the hell out of them, really. It had the opposite effect. The British intended this policy to intimidate neutrals in the upcountry of the Carolinas who were not keen on what they thought of as the hotheads in Charleston and Williamsburg.
The ones who wanted freedom, wanted independence,
independence, exactly. It was kind of, independence was a sort of rich man's plaything, really, as far as these smallholders with two or three or four slaves were concerned. But the spectre, the possibility that the British might be doing this, had this extraordinary blowback effect. They became part of the American cause as quickly as they could.
Well, so, you say what I had never seen before, that essentially the southern states, Virginia, North and South Carolina, and Georgia, the revolution of them was about maintaining slavery.
I think at the beginning, that you can pin it down in the summer and autumn, when George Washington calls Lord Dunmore, that arch traitor to humanity for presuming to free the slaves. It is absolutely about protecting the slaveholding world.
And this is
1775. Right at the beginning.
Well, and interestingly enough, going back to the history piece of this, that same argument between the uplands and the lowlands of North Carolina reappears 90 years later, actually much less than that, 60 years later, 50 years later, with the abolitionist movement. It's the only place in the South where you had substantial abolitionist pressure, leading up to the Civil War. And it's the same process, and you again have, in a much more limited fashion, slaves running away, this time on the Underground Railroad.
Right.
Also headed for Canada.
Also headed for Canada.
Well, of course, actually, as somebody reminded me the other night, Lincoln rather takes a leaf out of. He is, of course, famously extremely selective about his view of emancipation when the idea first comes to him. That's utterly a leaf out of the British book, because I must say. And this is a book which tries, while it adjusts many people's views of what the beginning of the revolution was like, including my own, I do not want it to be replaced by ungrounded British self-congratulation. So it should better be said right away that the deal that Lord Dunmore offered was only to slaves leaving rebel plantations. If you're a slave of a loyalist, tough luck, wasn't going to happen. Which again leads to the thought, not faced in my book, and I don't quite know why, actually. It wasn't for the sake of running away. But people always ask me, and I bet they do this evening at the meeting, well, supposing it had gone the other way. I mean, Frederick Douglass said famously, if the American Revolution had been lost, two generations of my people would be free sooner. But would they? What view? I wish I could confidently, with abolitionism a mass movement in Britain, say, well, I suppose one can say in 1838 it would have been abolished, because it was abolished in the West Indies, which was still. But would the British actually have stood by and created a huge population of free blacks in 1800? Gee, I wonder. I just actually don't know the answer to the question.
Well, this goes to your question about freedom and democracy, and it also brings in the whole colonial mindset.
Well, and colonialism in the world in the last 500 years is an enormous subject that touches everything and everybody to this moment.
Right. And I say that about colonialism because a lot of the American experience is a colonial experience.
Right.
You know, coming out
having
of the,
been one and then well,
having been
it
one,
on
but
others.
Also but specifically the British manifestation of colonialism, which of course was applied in a lot of different ways, but with a lot of similarity all over the world, including Sierra Leone as an example.
Here's a weird thing, precisely, actually, taking that point a little further, is that we now, because of the bitter experience of empire all over the world, assume that it's always been a kind of milch cow, you know, that its engine, well, it would be naive to assume its engine wasn't economic, you know, ferocity, really, sort of economic acquisitiveness. However, it's also, in some sense, naive to look at all those do-gooders coming straight out of, you know, Episcopalian vicarages and going to India, for example, and say they're all a bunch of worthless hypocrites, they were just kind of window dressing. They obviously weren't, you know. So there's an odd way in which there are species of colonialism which have buried within them a sort of called a meliorist itch, an improver's itch, an itch to sort of make the world better rather than less good. And you have to decide under whose auspices can that happen. It's both good and not good. It's dangerous and worthwhile.
It's that baby in the bathwater, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, it's also the complexity of the, I mean, it's not, you know, we got democracy and you don't, we're free and you're not. It is a much richer and it is an evolving process. And the process evolves within the context of a bigger history.
And co-evolves.
Right. The story about Nova Scotia and Sierra Leone.
Right.
It's not as, how to say, dramatic to an American as that relationship between the two countries during the Revolution,
but what the United States and England,
and the role in slavery in that context. Mm. But once it moves into the British domain,
right,
into this colonial domain, first with Nova Scotia and then with Sierra Leone, the whole process to me gets much richer, much more complicated, and goes to the kinds of discussions that you bring up. You've got a lot of bad guys, you've got a few good guys, You've got these people who are perpetual pawns, and interestingly enough, and this may be as important as anything, develop character in the process. It's a lousy way to develop character, but you say over and over again that this is the first shared character.
It's in this kind of disastrous, almost diaspora experience. I mean, we should just say that what then happens to the many thousands of escaped slaves, now free slaves, who are evacuated with the British. And the answer is, from Charleston, Savannah, many thousands of them, horrifyingly, were resold into slavery. Many, many of them were not, became the nucleus of free black planters in the Bahamas, for example. There's this critical group of 3,000 who are stuck in New York at the end of the war when Washington is trying to enforce Article 7 of the Treaty of Paris, which says there shall be no carrying off by the British of property and Negroes, and is being hounded by his fellow slave owners all over the South to do just that. And the last commander-in-chief of the British Army, not very interesting man, but very, as we say in Britain, good egg. Mankiewicz, the guy, Carleton, who goes on to be the governor of Canada. And it was a wonderful scene, actually. I mean, Washington was irked for many reasons by Guy Carleton, partly because so many people kept on telling them how much alike they looked. And the last person George Washington wanted to be told he looked like was the last incompetent commander-in-chief of the other side. Anyway, there they are at this little summit conference when Washington is going to say, what are the arrangements for restoring the property of, you know, of my fellow Americans to them? And Carleton has this wonderfully annoying British habit of pretending not quite to understand. So he says, "My dear General, I'm sure I must be wrong, but you can't possibly be proposing that I violate the obligations undertaken in good faith by the King, his government, and my fellow generals, that we honour the promises we made to people, persons of all colour." He says, "people of all colour." Very movingly, we have the verbatim account by a loyalist attorney general. I love this ploy. And he says, I'm obviously not to understand because somebody as decent and upright couldn't possibly suggesting that we treat these people like things, like property. And of course, Washington wants to say, well, that's actually exactly what I'm suggesting. So he goes red and shouts a bit, which he doesn't usually do, and shuts up. And they do go with they leave with the British to massive heartbreak, which we'll probably talk about in a minute.
Oh, Simon Sharma also does lots of things for the BBC, so he takes cues remarkably well. We'll all be back in that moment. Please join us when we return.